Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking with Christy Anderson of Syracuse University, who's the author of the 2010 book, New Immigrant Communities, Finding a Place in Local Politics. I hope you enjoy the podcast. And welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and I'm talking to Christy Anderson of Syracuse University today. Christy, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
It's a real pleasure to read your book, New Immigrant Communities, Finding a Place in Local Politics. I've had the real pleasure to read the book, and I'm sure that other people have read it. But before we get to the actual meat of the book, maybe you can just tell us all just a little bit about yourself, where you are, where you've been before. Who are you?
Well, I am currently the Chapel Family Professor of Citizenship and Democracy at Syracuse, and I've been here in the Maxwell School at Syracuse University for 28 years, I think. I taught for a little while at Ohio State before that, got my PhD at the University of Chicago. This book was a new kind of area for me. I, a long time ago, wrote a dissertation and then a book about the New Deal realignment and argued that the creation of that new Democratic majority was in part due to pulling in people who hadn't been in the electorate before, in particular immigrants and immigrants' children in the 1920s and 1930s. So I was sort of interested in that process, in the process of how new Americans, new people, new young people, immigrants and so on, women who had just gotten the right to vote were brought into the active electorate. And I had gone away from that research, you know, program and was doing other things, but got increasingly interested in current immigrants as immigration rose in the, late 90s and early 2000s. And so I increasingly was curious about what was happening, particularly in terms of political parties and politics and pulling people into the electorate with regard to the people who were now migrating to the United States. So that was the origin of thinking about, not really the book, but of thinking about current immigration and the politics of immigration.
Yeah, and let's talk about the book. And you know, I always like to start with the most obvious starting point, which is just simply the title. And I think the title actually does describe literally what your book is, but also some of what your take is on the subject and sort of the after the colon, finding a place in local politics, I think says something about kind of what your thesis is. So in terms of your starting point for this project, one of the things that I really liked about the book was that you were not focused on some of the well-known immigrant cities. There have been a lot written about New York and Los Angeles and a handful of other big cities, but you approached this in a slightly different way, and you chose six different cities to focus your research. So how did you choose these six, and why did you choose these six? Why were these good cases for you to investigate?
Well, first of all, as you say, the traditional immigrant gateways, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami, have been studied, and those are a particular sort of environment for immigrants. In particular, because they all have huge immigrant populations, even a very narrow group. So Dominicans in New York, for example, or Salvadorians in Los Angeles. There are lots of them, and they tend to be living close together. This provides a particular kind of political context. It makes politicizing them perhaps easier. It makes them a potential, or that group, once they attain citizenship, they have potential power politically because they're a group in a particular political geographic area and so forth. And many of the, not only political scientists have studied immigrants in these traditional gateway cities, but this has been the focus of many sociological studies as well. So we understand quite a lot and based on years of research on immigrants coming to these established immigrant places in a way. And so I was interested just in how it works elsewhere. I was I had become interested in Syracuse, which is a city which has hosted a lot of refugees starting in the 1970s with Vietnamese and then a whole bunch of Bosnian refugees or people from the former Yugoslavia, and then more recently Burmese and Somalians and a whole lots of different Africans and Southeast Asian immigrants. A graduate student and I did a sort of qualitative study of some of the organizations in Syracuse that worked with immigrants and refugees. And from that, I got some funding and decided to design a study focusing on cities roughly the sort of cities that Syracuse was. And how I selected them is really to look at the census data and find cities. And I don't remember exactly what the population parameters are, but, certainly less than a million, over a couple hundred thousand. I wanted cities that were comparable in terms of the recent immigration that they had, the trends of immigration. But I wanted cities that differed in the types of immigrants and the types of immigration. So the cities are Syracuse, Lansing, Michigan, Waco, Texas, Fort Collins, Colorado, Chico, California, and Spokane, Washington. And some of those have large refugee populations like Syracuse, Spokane, Lansing. Others are mostly Mexican immigrants, Fort Collins and Waco. And the cities vary in terms of their economic situations and other things, too. So I'm not really able to generalize, but I wanted to get a sense of what the factors were that shaped the reception of the immigrants and how they settled into the cities and how they became or didn't become involved in politics.
Yeah, I spent time, I'm now in New York City with this very traditional immigrant story, but spent time in Virginia. And Virginia's more recent immigrant story is so very different, but also I think very interesting. I think your book, by taking on these different cities, does a really interesting job of telling a story that maybe isn't always told to the same extent. So moving on a little bit, you have a chapter about the role of political parties, and this relates, it sounds like, to some previous research that you've done. But in 2013, there's a very high level of interest in immigrants. But you kind of argue in the book that this always hasn't been the case. So maybe you can just sort of summarize a little bit, what has the history of the major parties in mobilizing immigrants been, and how would you characterize that attitude today in contrast?
Well, the parties have, and I guess I would say parties are multifaceted organizations. I'm not necessarily talking about national parties, but parties mm-hmm. at local and state levels have, I guess, reached out to and mobilized immigrants historically, when it was to their advantage to do so. There's a really, one of the best books about this is by Stephen Erie called Rainbow's End, and he talks about, he's basically talking about Irish in politics, but really immigrants in general in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And so when parties, like in New York City, were in the 19th century, were in competitive situations, then it behooved a party to, as in our stereotypes, meet the boats, when they came mm-hmm. to Ellis Island and get people jobs and give them baskets of food and help them become citizens and so forth. But when to take again the example of New York, when Tammany Hall was dominant later on, when the post-Irish immigrants arrived in New York, they weren't really that concerned about naturalizing or integrating the immigrants and getting them to be supporters of that party. They didn't really need them. So I think parties are self-interested organizations, and this is what I found in my study. In these cities, these immigrants, it's more complicated than that because in these particular cities, the immigrant groups often weren't big enough to provide much of an advantage to parties to get them registered and mobilized and everything. But basically, parties in more recent years, local political parties in more recent years, have not necessarily seen immigrants as benefiting their parties. There are several reasons I say that. One is that in order to, if you as a party, your party decision makers are thinking about adding new groups to your coalition, you have to think about the potential negative reaction of the groups you already have. So that's one issue. The other issue is really just one of kind of reducing uncertainty in a way. That is, parties, if they have a coalition, particularly if they're dominant in a particular area, they know who they can rely on. They know what groups they can rely on. It's a lot of effort, time, money, initiative to get people, certainly get people to become citizens, help them naturalize, and then to get people to register, and then to get them to vote for the party. And that adds, in a sense, uncertainty. If they don't need those people, they don't go after them. And that's what I found in these cities, that there wasn't much activity on the part of the parties. They, in most cases, they were not the naturalizers and registrers and mobilizers mm-hmm. of times past. And other people have found this to be the case as well. You know, now we see, after the election of 2012, that there have been organizations who have worked and are working to register and get and activate Hispanic voters in particular now.
Yeah, and in some way, I think you refer to benign neglect at one point, but there is this gap, and it seems like one of the arguments you're making is that into this gap steps community organizations. So how well have community organizations, you know, provided for recent immigrants with links to civic life, a role that political parties, you know, whether they were self-interested in providing jobs, shelter, access to public services, they were providing those services and were able to provide for certain levels of assimilation. Are community organizations now providing that in these six cities? Were you able to find that this was happening to a greater extent in one of the cities than in others, or in different ways?
All the various organizations, and they range from, you know, churches to organizations that are specifically created by immigrants to refugee resettlement agencies. So as a whole, these community organizations do provide support for immigrants in various ways. You know, they provide translation, they provide help with negotiating the bureaucracy, they provide help in getting jobs, they provide English classes, all of these things, that some of which political parties did help provide in years past. So some of the change is that, and people talk about the New Deal and the greater government role in providing social services that came into being at that time as taking away some of the capability of parties or the opportunity for parties to provide these services to people. So a lot of these community organizations essentially act as to help immigrants connect to government services, government-provided services, or when those are lacking, they provide those services. But that's their mission, that's their goal, these community organizations. They obviously have different other goals, and some of the ones who are advocates have more political aims, but unlike the political parties who were, in a sense, doing these things in a self-interested, as you say, way, they were providing services in return for support, in return for votes, and party activism, these community organizations are only occasionally doing that. I mean, they may be providing services and then hoping that the people that they're working with will turn out for a protest or help them in a letter writing campaign, but it's not, their goals are not the same. They're not trying to get elected. So they're in a very different position than the parties were or presumably are or could be right now. And so their political socialization, if you want to use that term, of these new citizens, or non-citizens, I mean, those people are served too, as well, is very different than the political socialization of immigrants by parties. I think I'm being kind of confusing here.
I think this is right on. And one of the things that I think makes sort of explaining these issues is sort of an outside of the academy, there is a hyper focus on voting.
Right.
And one of the reasons that's there are obvious reasons why there is that hyper focus. But one of the harmful aspects of that, and you note this in your book, is what that tends to do is leave out lots of other forms of political participation. And that's particularly important for immigrants because some portion don't have voting rights. Now, they have lots of political rights, but they may not have voting rights. And so it seems to me that that's sort of a big part of what your book and other related books are trying to grapple with is to make sense of, you know, the numbers that some immigrant groups vote at very low levels. But what does it mean about their larger political forms of political participation? One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, and it comes up in the book, is something that's been happening for a long time, but it happened in the course of the last couple of years, is some very, very hostile legislative moves and some very hostile anti-immigration sentiments in many of the parts of the country. How does that interact with what you study? Were you having conversations and interviews with some of these civic organizations where they identified that as a major challenge they were facing? How does that work into this larger story that you're telling?
Well, in these particular places, those hostile legislative and political moves and just the hostile, you know, kind of cultures that the immigrants had to deal with in these various cities had just two very different impacts in a sense. I heard about and talked to people about those sorts of contexts really dampening the possibilities for getting immigrants involved. You know, that I was told repeatedly that, you know, even if person X is not an illegal or undocumented immigrant, he or she probably has, almost certainly has, family, friends, other people in their community who are. They
right.
don't want to come to the city hall and sit at a town or, a city council meeting. They don't want to necessarily join a protest. All of these things are potentially dangerous. So that... Mm-hmm. That hampers the ability sometimes of community organizations, advocacy organizations to get people mobilized and get people active. On the other hand, there were a number of incidents, some of which I talk about in the book, I think, where anti-immigrant behaviors, I think I remember in Chico where people burned down an immigrant farm stand or something, really got people, immigrants and their allies and their supporters, which is an interesting point, upset and mobilized and in some cases brought about policy or legislative changes which were favorable to help the immigrant community.
It sounds to me like you may be drawing on some of this, but you mentioned towards the end of the book that you convened a one-day workshop where you invited practitioners from the different cities that you'd focused on to Washington, D.C. How did you integrate that into the book? How did that work? Was this a big event? Were these sort of focus groups? You mentioned that you discussed some of the preliminary findings of the book. How did you use that as a researcher to help tell the larger story of the book project?
Well, that was really an interesting thing that happened. It came about. I hadn't intended for that to be necessarily part of the book. I mean, I certainly had, you know, talked to some of these people, and you know, people knew I was working on a book project. But What happened was I had some research money left over. There were several of my colleagues who were also interested in this, including a graduate student who had worked with me doing interviews, and we decided to have, it was not a big event, it was very small, it was probably 15 people from these various cities who could come and spend a day, day and a half in Washington at Syracuse University facility there. And it was fairly structured. So we had ideas that we wanted them to talk about or concepts that we wanted them to talk about. But as part of the book, in the end of the book, I wanted to generalize a little bit about what I had found, what the patterns were, and what sorts of conditions seemed to produce better political integration or less good political integration of immigrants. But I also wanted, in the end, after I spent this time with these folks, to use their wisdom, in a sense, and use their experiences to talk about, from the point of view of these organizations, immigrant organizations, what made sense, what were their challenges, what were their successes, what were the problems that they had managed to solve. And so that's the other part of the end of the book, or the other conclusion, is really letting these people talk about their own specific experiences and political efforts.
Yeah, and you're very clear throughout the entire book that because of the method you chose, the goal was not to provide largely, was not to generalize widely from the findings. But you do have a story to tell, and there are some lessons, if they're not statistical generalizations, they are lessons. I wonder if you could summarize those. What do we take away from this, from these 6 days, even if we're just, generalizing to these six? What is the big story that you have to tell here?
Well, some of the story is about ways that you can sustain civic engagement, that you want people to be active, and your point about voting or other forms of participation is well taken, because they mostly weren't necessarily talking about voting. They were talking about getting people to understand the civic terrain, getting people to understand the local and state politics. So how do you get people, particularly young people, they were interested in getting them engaged in politics? So we got very specific. What kind of communications methods worked? I mean, did these people want to be emailed, or did you meet them at their churches? Do they like newsletters? How do you get people to be active and to be engaged? And they talked a lot about strategic planning. They didn't want to, which is common to every organization. This is not, something unique to these organizations. How do you sustain the organization? How do you not have leaders burn out? How do you have new generations of leadership? They also talked a lot. I thought one interesting conversation we had was, how do you connect to local politics and local parties, and how do you make these links? And some of the people that were at this little workshop, one was a city council member, others had run for office, sometimes successfully, and they talked about reaching out to political parties, making their positions known, trying to keep their agenda, the agenda of these immigrant groups, at the top of the local agenda. They talked about communicating with the press and, building good relationships with people in the community and so forth. None of this was, in a way, unique or specific to, you could read all that and put it in a different context, put it in context of, how do you get young people in general to be active, or how do you get marginalized groups in general to be active? It's not, some of it was specific to immigrants and their challenges, but it's really about how do you build good community organizations which have an impact on the community?
Yeah, no, and, I think that's one of the interesting things in their there's sort of a number of people working on some similar issues. And I think one of the ideas is sort of, you know, what can we generalize to the larger population of civic organizations?
Right.
What can we, you know, generalize to the larger population of youth voters? And so for that reason, I think there's an awful lot to be learned from this book.
Well, one of
one
of the wonderful things that the things that I felt very good about this day and a half I found these people is these folks all had, you know, tiny organizations running on a shoestring, always out of money, really working hard. They loved spending this time together,
yeah,
talking to each other and getting some affirmation and support. That was just so. That's important, you know, to kind of reach out of your own organization, talk to other people, share ideas, and so forth. The other point I would make in response to your, you know, what do you do to generalize this to other civic organizations and so on, is the importance of allies, the importance in this case of people who were established in the community, who were progressive groups, liberal groups, youth groups, universities were important. I argued that they provided important venues and expertise and support and so on for a lot of these community organizations. So just being able to have support and get expertise from elsewhere and being able to build alliances is important.
Yeah. Now, this book came out a couple of years ago. What's on your table now? Has anything come out subsequent to this? Are you still working on this issue, or have you shifted your focus at all?
I am not working specifically on this issue. Some of my teaching is now more about immigration policy, so I've been thinking about immigration policy. But my writing lately has actually regressed back to the New Deal, so I'm getting back into doing political history a little bit now.
Great. Well, Christy, it was a real pleasure to read your book, New Immigrant Communities, Finding a Place in Local Politics. It's published from Lynn Reiner in 2010. I'm sure that it's available in all sorts of different places. Christy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. I really enjoyed it.